What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either, really.
Go.
No. Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode. And also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here. Will you describe the image of the strings and how that works and how you imagine and conceptualize it?
Yeah. So when Charlie was first born, I felt just incredibly tethered to him. And any time that he wasn't like in my arms or directly on my body, I felt very painful. I felt like someone was being torn from me was the sensation. If he was like in the same room as me and someone I knew really well, I mean, no one I didn't know was holding him, but if it was like my partner or my partner's parents or something, it was like, okay, but there was still this like sting. But if he was out of the room and away from me, it was very painful. And so the way that I was like kind of understanding that feeling is I started drawing him kind of being stretched away from me. And when I first started drawing it, it wasn't really strings. It was like our bodies being torn. And then as he kept getting older, that feeling would like shift and change. When he started like getting down and crawling, I was like so aware of the space that was between us. And so I started thinking of it in terms of these strings. And you and I have talked a lot about preemptive nostalgia. And so I would just start grieving this time when he was like really far away from me. So then I started imagining like all the ways that I could infuse like elasticity into these so that they wouldn't have to snap, that they could stretch, and how like gently they could get pulled. So then there would be like this natural like fraying and just like separation instead of like a tug that like broke something, which really feels like repair, like going back. Like if like it feels like when Charlie and I have conflict or I do something that feels like it's not the way that I want to be speaking or parenting him, it feels like those strings are getting pulled on really hard. And sometimes I think we have snapped. There are things that have like snapped that maybe won't ever come quite back together. And some of that is like, I think just normal and maybe good or right. But when we come back and he and I talk and I like apologize or we like work through what was happening, we understand each other, I feel like we're doing something to the substance of those strings, is like getting more resilient, more stretchy.
Yeah, we can be strained and stay connected. We can feel a rift and then tend to that little fissure. Mm-hmm. That image has come back to me over and over and over again, both as like a way to understand the like physical pain of this relationship and like watching him grow so fast and separate from me so quickly, like in real time. And I'm constantly like with the child who was just an infant and who's about to go off to college, like all of those things at the same time. But I think also as a framework for a picture of what I hope for in the long term, which is that he could be on the other side of the globe and we would have these strands where we're still connected and so far apart, and still the stretchiness of this like expands across the planet. That's what I want. So thank you for putting that image into the universe.
It brings me a lot of comfort. I think a lot about how I am. The phrase that I use a lot is like, I'm at once every age I've ever been. And I think about the fact that as Charlie grows, he is still the same, like the version that I am interacting with now will still live inside his body when he's like 30. And so the quality of the relationship and how I tend to it is just setting up what that will be when he's older. Or at least that is how I handle this immense, constant grief of like having something that is beyond me, but is fundamentally a part of me.
Yeah.
What vision did you have of a parent, a caregiver, a mother, a birthing person?
I have like very sharp memories of like the physicality of this role, of like, especially like the image I had of like capital M mother, of starting with my own mom. But, you know, I have 5 older siblings. So my sisters and my brother's partners. And I have images of like babies on hips while you're making a sandwich at the kitchen counter and another like toddler's hanging on your leg. Like the physicality of that is very, I noticed that and it meant something to me. I think maybe in large part because that would not be mirrored in my physicality, you know, like that. I knew that that's not how I would hold a baby or how I couldn't interact with a counter kitchen space that way. You know, like that was separate from me in a very clear way with a clear boundary. I also had lots of pictures. I mean, most of the mothers that I knew had many kids, you know, 5, 6, 7 kids and started really young and, you know, there's like every 2, 2.5 years, we're having another. So all of that, I think, made that role feel really unattainable to me. But I was, you know, I have 25 nieces and nephews, and I think I was there for like 23 of their births, not in the room, but like in the waiting room or just, you know, just outside, like held all of those newborn babies and watched all of those pregnancies and labors and the anticipation and waiting and the like just overwhelming joy of witnessing all of that and the excitement in our whole family, the high value on that in our whole family, and as being one of the most like important markers in a life of that parent. So as I got older, I mean, I think when I was very young, I definitely like took on that role of mother. Like I would nurse my babies, which is a strange thing to think about. Like there are these videos of me as a 3-year-old with my baby doll and I'm like nursing this baby doll. So there was this like very early sort of like automatic, this is what I do with my body too kind of instinct. And then I don't know when it would have been that I started to pull back from that. Maybe when my siblings started having babies and I actually like saw my people doing this and it was harder to imagine. But by the time I was like, well, I mean, this is for probably another episode, but like divorced very young and like out on my own and not partnered in my late 20s, you know, like, oh, what an old maid. But like, I'm sort of moving off into this new map, creating this new map for myself. And so thinking about trying to imagine myself as a mother at that point was very much like I just couldn't actually imagine it happening by the time I was like at the age when I would be doing it. I could not imagine it actually working. And even if my brain was like, no, there's a way to do this differently and make it work, I think there was just something like very deep in my body that didn't believe that that could actually work or happen. And was pretty shocked even by just like getting pregnant. I was like, wait, I didn't think that that actually could even happen. Not because of facts, not because of reality or science or what my doctors eventually told me once I like pushed them on it and we like were moving that way, but just because like something in my body did not know how to imagine that for me.
What do you feel like would have shifted that? Like, would it have been seeing disabled parents or just like more, what is it that was missing?
It's hard to know for sure, but like I do know that witnessing, we're going to talk to Alex on a different episode, but Alex Wegman is a parent who uses a wheelchair. And I found her account maybe like a couple of years before I got pregnant, I think, but she has 2 kids and truly like, looking at images of this parent sitting in her wheelchair doing this job, really did shift something in my brain. There's another Instagram account, and her videos, she had like these very practical videos of like, this is how I get my 3-month-old off the floor from a wheelchair. And I would just watch that, like, what does that look like? What does that motion look like? How do you do that? And every body is different. And I ended up figuring out my own ways of doing that. But yes, like literally seeing other models of that, I think really did like shift something deep in me. And the way that Alex would talk about parenting too. I remember one of the things I read, like when we were beginning to start thinking about actually doing this, Alex had a post about like her kid learning to ride a bike, I think, or like early days of riding a bike, and how they were like, Alex was in this cul-de-sac. I'm probably bungling this. This is just what I remember. It's like they were in this cul-de-sac and there were like neighbors around, and it was this way that Alex was reflecting on like there are other adults that were like ushering in this new skill set for her kid that she wasn't, and that like they were there to catch and do like some of that parenting or whatever you would call it, caring for her kid. And that picture of like the sturdiness and flexibility and humility, I think also, like if that's the right word for it, but like I don't have to have an ego about this and say that I'm the only one who can keep my kids safe or watch over this experience, but that we can bring other people into this, and that could be a version of what parenting looks like. That felt possible to me. And I think empowering to me to like have someone reflecting on that ahead of time, like before I stepped into that. It's like a different picture of what this can be and what this role can mean. And in my picture, it was like there's one mother, and the mother is responsible for all of the care and knows all of the answers and all the weight of the responsibility of whatever tasks need to be accomplished will be on this parent. Like, this was just a very different model to have and kind of sparked. There was like actual opening up in my head of like what this could be. Also, as a side note, to go back to our bit about like representing other people's stories, my dad was a very involved parent, but just in a very different way. He was home from like 6:30 on in the evening and then present on the weekends, you know, like a very 9-to-5 job. And my mom did a lot of the traditional tasks in the house. But anyways, all that to say, yeah, I do think that like seeing other people doing it a different way was a huge part for me. And I don't know what that would have been like when I was younger and what that would have meant for me. I mean, in some ways, Caitlin, weirdly, to like pinpoint some of the both ends of this, I'm kind of glad that I got to experience being outside of that, you know, like I'm kind of glad that my body and brain were pushed into this position of like, that's not the thing that I want to do. And what are other things that I can fill my life with and build my life around? And what are other paths that I want to take? Like, I think I like that about my life journey. And so I don't know what it would have been like to have that picture early. In some ways, I think that would be great. And in some ways, I kind of appreciate the fact that I went a long time seeking out other things in my life outside of it. So it's both.
I wonder, as this like third magical thing, is that like, could you have seen people like you that you identified with doing, not having kids, having kids, waiting to have kids, having kids early, having kids and a career, only having a career, staying at home with their, you know, like how many different stories could you have seen? So that then, I think this is the part where it's like, we didn't know, I feel like you said this in the beginning, like you didn't know what you wanted because you hadn't, and I feel like that's if you haven't seen some examples or seen examples of people doing multiple things, you couldn't even imagine your own. Not that you need to see different people doing so you could want to do their thing, but that it would give you permission to do your own.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it does feel a little bit like, is there a version of me that exists that I don't know. Like, I feel this way with a lot of disability representation in general of like, it wasn't just that I didn't know how to be what like motherhood or parenting would look like to me. It was also like, I don't know how I'm going to have a job. I don't know that anyone's going to love me. I mean, there's like a lot of things in that, like, what do you see represented to you? And I do think that there is something powerful for all of us and just like a huge variety of like storylines and maps and arcs that people can follow throughout a lifetime. Like it does seem like there are a handful that get like this prominent place in our collective stories. And then all of the outliers that a lot of us like just don't hear about or see or know about. And I do think that like the mere act of opening that up, there's just something that sparks in your imagination of like knowing that there are other paths. I think you're right. But so for you, did you have any of that? I mean, you had Bethany for a while that was going out and having those adventures, but did you have other models?
I think Bethany gave me the spark of like, the thing that I think carried kind of over from that is I was like, I really wanted to be a writer for a while. And I had some like, I wanted to move to the city, which the like city TM was St. Louis, because that's where Bethany was. And so it was all I could imagine. But I also was just seeing one very specific type of mother. And the thing that stuck out the most to me about it is that it should be done without breaking a sweat. Like the way that your kids behave is a direct reflection on you and how well you're doing. And you should always look perfect. Your kids should always look perfect. Like you should be, it was about very 50s housewife. Like you should be in heels. Your house should be clean. The roast is on the table. And I definitely had like, I just pictured that. And I'm an Enneagram 3. And I was like, I'll be a pastor's wife, because that was like the highest thing that I could imagine attaining. And I would like play piano. I would always like, when I would play piano as a kid, I would imagine myself like with my row of children and like playing and everyone being so, you know, amazed at my talent and beauty. Yeah, that was the image I held. And then I did break away from that. I think there is a world in which I could have like married my high school boyfriend and had 3 kids right now.
I did marry my high school boyfriend. I'm really glad we didn't have any children. But yes, an alternate life out there.
Then I rejected it. I was like, I'm not having kids. My career is what matters. I will not do this.
When and how?
It was somewhere between undergrad and grad school. Because I was still really thinking about babies a lot. Like when Andrew and I started dating when I was like 20, 21. And when our year anniversary came, I was like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, if we're not getting married, what is even the point of this? Because, and thank God he like was raised very differently and had a steady head. And he was like, that is insane. Yeah. But for me, it was like, if you don't get married with like, what is the point? What are your intentions? But then I did end up getting married and going to grad school and coming out. And I was like, no children. And by that time, I mean, I'd been caregiving. I think the first time I took a babysitting job, I was 12. And then when I was like 15, I worked for a family who had quintuplets.
Quintuplets is 5.
And there was an older and a younger child. So there were 7 children.
How old were you when you were babysitting all those kids?
Between like 14 and 16.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't doing that.
Yeah, and it was very affirming to me to like have everyone's sandwiches were out and everyone was practicing their music and the kitchen was cleaned. And I was like, I was very good at doing those things. I mean, I was like bred to be a housewife. I genuinely do love creating a nurturing space. My house is the space that all of the wayward, hurting, whatever, nieces and nephews end up at. Like, I am the caregiver still, and I think that will always be just a role or curse or blessing or identity.
Well, like you do that with your friends too. It's not even just...
Yeah, and it's something I love. But I watched my sisters having kids and having kids and having kids. And I was like, oh, right. And I watched The Strain. I watched just a lot of hard things happening. And I was like, no, that is not for me. I have dreams and desires and things that I want to do.
And you were in grad school. So you're also like probably face to face with those things, those desires, those goals, those that dream for yourself, and not seeing the way that that could coexist.
I didn't. When I was like, I want to have a kid, I spent a year finding the people who were the creatives, who were the people with like interesting, important career, like not careers as in like climbing corporate ladder, but career as in making the work that they wanted to make in the world. And the people who lived near me, I started taking out and interviewing. I'd be like, can I buy you coffee? And also ask you all the questions about how you are being a parent. I like, there's like three of them that are just like kind of burnt in my memory of just like taking these people out. So it's very strategic and very researched. And I was like, but I couldn't really, until I got a new image of what it could be, because I had, there was one way that you could be a parent. And I was like, I don't want this life.
So you went out to find those other pictures. You were like, I don't have other pictures of how this could be, but there must be other pictures out there. So I'm going to go find them.
Yeah, I think social media played a huge role because I could find people in almost any configuration that I could find on there. So I started just like seeing people like Jessica Hish, who she was lettering and was like one of my like heroes in undergrad. She had a kid and I was like, what the fuck? And she like talked about her kid. She like posted a photo of her. I remember it was like felt, I think her oldest is now like 8 or something, but posted a picture of her like postpartum and she still like had a belly and she showed it. And I was like, what the fuck is happening? It was just like, I it was like a picture of her like standing on a street corner with a stroller and she wasn't trying to hide the fact that she looked like she just had a baby. And then I heard her talking on some podcasts about what it was. And I was like, okay, this person had a kid. So it was like slowly people trickled in and I started seeing it. And then I started seeking it out like in my like specific community.
Yeah. Because I was wondering if it was like you just had this very deep desire, but you didn't know how to make it work in the way that you wanted to. So you sought out these images. But it sounds more like you had shut it down. And then there were these few little sparks where you were like, oh, wait a minute, there might be space for this longing and this kind of life.
Yeah. I also in there, which is probably like a whole other conversation, for 6 months, I just like Andrew and I were suddenly parenting 3 children from like 5 to 14.
Your nieces and nephews, right?
Yeah, my 3 nephews. So that was wild. And we were like great at it. It was also like hell and horrible. And also I was like, oh, wow.
But we're doing it and we're doing it together.
Yeah. And I kind of, there were parts of it that I really, really loved. So I think that also awakened something in me.
And then by the time you finished with all of that, you were like, oh, no, this, I can do this and I want to do this and I have no hesitation and we're doing it.
I mean, I wouldn't say no hesitation, but yeah, I was like, let's.
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
It's interesting to think of like your embodied experience as this caregiver when you were younger with like all the perfect sandwiches and your image of being at the piano with all of your like adoring children beside you. Like, was it difficult for you to start to embody this other version of parenting? And like, was it just conversations with these other people and imagining it? Or how did you leap from the the way you had done this caregiving as a teenager to this other version.
I feel like that group that I started with you and May and
Chelsea, yeah.
I had this dream. I like woke up in the middle of the night and I was like, these people, I need these people. And I like think I sent you all an email in the middle of the night. And I was like, we're going to make something together, which we never really ended up making anything together. But we met like weekly. We just had a standing weekly thing. And wherever we were, whatever we were doing, there was like a lot of children in the backgrounds. But that was, I was really needing, I still feel in some ways, it's lessening now, that I was like not a real mom because I was doing things differently. And anytime I wasn't with Charlie, I felt like I wasn't a mom or a parent.
It's interesting to hear you say that because like observing you as a parent, it feels so obvious that you very much were from the very first minute and that you seemed like yourself and doing this work and it seemed natural and it seemed, I mean, easy. So it's like interesting to hear you say that even by the point, like was Charlie like 1.5 when we started that group?
Maybe. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think it was definitely a year, year and a half. It's lessened, but I feel like I've had so much childcare. Like he's not with me very much. And if he's not with me and I'm not taking care of every need, like, you know, am I real? Do I have purpose? What is the point of me? Because of the ways that I was like, I'm supposed to do all of these things. Yeah, it was really hard in the early days. It's way less hard now. So much of it, I think, is like societal. When I'm just like quiet and still inside myself, I feel pretty fucking confident about what I'm doing. But when I add in all the other things and I'm worried about how I'm being perceived, that part feels really hard. I do still have twinges of, I feel like I have so much childcare. He spends so much time away from me. And like, does that make me a bad parent or like not a real one?
That's interesting that that's part of the narrative that you have absorbed about what this role is, that is that piece that, and I have it too, of like, you are supposed to be the entire universe to him and meet every need and know every magic trick to soothe him. And you're the only one who can do it. And the fact that there are other people in your community that can catch him and hold him and other adults that know how to comfort him and all of that, that would feel, I mean, it's so interesting and I relate to you that would feel like somehow that's undermining your role, your purpose, your usefulness.
Yeah. In the beginning, it was really hard too because I watched Andrew's parents care for him with such ease. I went, oh my God, there was this moment. I didn't ever put shoes on him. I just wanted him to like just his feet touching the ground. And so when he started walking for a good period of time, he didn't wear shoes. And it was also like still pandemic times. It's not like I was taking him public with no shoes. But we would go to the park and he would just run around the park without shoes on. And it was getting to a point where we were like, oh, okay, we need to put shoes on him. And one day, Andrew's parents always send us photos when they have him. Tracy sent a photo of him wearing, I still remember, there's green shoes. And I had been like research labor over what is the best shoe to get him. And Tracy had just like thrifted a pair of shoes and they were great. And it was like, they were taking him out places and he needed shoes on. But I was so devastated. I was wrecked. Like I just sobbed and sobbed. And I was so upset. Andrew like talked to his mom and was like, hey, like it was a whole moment. And like, they are so wonderful. Tracy and I had like a whole moment about it. It ended up being really beautiful.
But it was the piece, like I should have been the one to find those shoes for him.
I felt so ashamed. I was like, I'm not caring for him well. Someone else realized my neglect and filled a role that I should have filled. And I think money has and continues to be a little like tricky because I will just watch the ease with which Andrew's parents will just like grab stuff for him, which is now I'm like grateful. I'm just like, great. Yes, please send those nice boots. We'll just share these boots and you can buy them. But at the time I was like, I didn't feel real if I wasn't doing like every piece of all of it.
I have like different versions of that too, like that carrying the baby on the hip image, which I've never done with Otto. I had a relative who scooped him up off the floor and was carrying him around on her hip. I thought my whole insides were like had turned to like lava, like river. I just was melting in the worst way. I was just imploding. It was like grief. It was shame. And that piece, I'm so interested in the way you talk about, like, I'm not a real mom, because that is language that my brain has just like spun like a blender around that language of like, you're not a real mom. And that was one of the things for me was like, your baby reached out to this other person for her to carry him on the hip because he recognizes that she's a real mom and she can do this for him and she can meet this need for him, which, like, I don't even know if that's a need that to be carried on one's hip. I don't know. But that's the narrative, right? That's the narrative that I have, is that like this is a need that he has that I can't fulfill. Which, by the way, like, of course he's going to have needs that I can't fulfill. Of course he's going to. And how wonderful for him to have a parent that can move through that with ease and is like, yay, someone else can come alongside and give you something that I can't. Yay. I don't think that's exactly what that was, but I think that that is something very real that will continue to happen across the whole arc of his life. And it doesn't, that doesn't diminish me or make me unreal, but this is the narrative that I also have. I cannot, must not, will never be a real mom. It's just so interesting to me that both of us have used that, our brains have spit out that language, because I think both of us would also be able to say, like, what the fuck is that? what is this? What is this image?
What does that even mean?
Yes. What does that mean? The real mom versus the not real mom. That doesn't mean anything. And yet it feels like it does. And there's something in my brain that believes that it is. So things started to slowly shift. You were having these conversations with other people doing things in different ways. You were changing within yourself and what you were imagining for yourself. And in those early years, you had these moments of feeling a bit like an imposter or not real. How has that evolved in the last couple of years? Charlie is almost 4. When do you feel like you are best version of parent Caitlin, like you are in your flow state, you're feeling yourself in this role, this is the parent version you were always meant to be, if that's even how you ever feel? I don't know.
God, it comes in waves. I get little glimpses. I think lately we've started having conversations. Last night we're going to bed. He asked for a show. I said no. And then he just like threw himself at me and started hitting me in the face. And my impulse was to throw him off of me, which is what I did. We were on a soft bed, but I didn't judge the fact that the dog was right now. And then Charlie cracked his forehead onto the dog's hard head. And I felt horrible. And he was crying. And I was upset. But I also was so pissed off that I really thought we had moved out of the phase of him hitting me. And we were both really activated. But then we like calmed down. I comforted him and we laid on the bed. And we like talked and I apologized. And then he was just kind of sitting there and he goes, you know, you should really say sorry to me. You should say sorry. You were mad. And I was like, yeah. I was like, yeah, I was really mad. I did get mad. You hit me in the face and I got mad. And I don't know, we had this, I think that there was so many things about what happened that was really sweet, but the fact that he could like feel like he could approach me and be like, you should apologize to me. And that I received that with like openness and not being like, you shouldn't hit me. And we did talk about how he can't hit when he gets mad. But then we also talked about the fact that I pushed him into the dog when I was mad. So like we both felt anger and we both reacted in ways that neither one of us should have. And it's not the ways that I have seen it handled and definitely would not have been handled that way when I was a kid. Those are the moments that I feel proud. I feel good. I feel real, quote unquote. And then he was like, it's okay to be mad. Did you know it's okay to be mad? And I was like, it is okay to be mad. We can get mad. And then I talked about like other things I could have done instead of pushing him and other things he could have done instead of hitting me. And it just felt really connective. Like, and then he just like fell asleep. Those are the moments that feel really, really, really good. And they're happening more that we're having conversations. So I think it's like times that we're talking feel good. And then times when we're not home, I don't like being at home very much. It's like messy. I get overwhelmed. I don't know what that piece is. I need to figure that out. But when we're out and doing, like when he and I jump on a plane and then go somewhere together, or if we're just like, I don't know, adventuring out in nature, I feel like more regulated and present.
That story is beautiful. I love that so much, in many layers of that. But it reminds me of that stretchy image. It sounds like that what you're doing is building a very stretchy bond that can withstand anger, that can withstand making the wrong choice, that can stay connected even in that kind of like within that kind of threat. I think like a rigid bond would be that as soon as someone snaps at the other person, we can't look at each other again, like we can't come back together. And it also makes me think about what you were saying about Charlie, like you are every version you've ever been and will ever be, and Charlie is too. And it makes me think about the ways that you will be interacting when Charlie's 17 and there's some kind of tension or fight or whatever it is. And like that impulse to come back together and repair is in his body.
God, I hope so.
It is. You're doing it.
It's the only thing. I mean, I want him to be like healthy and happy and successful in whatever way that feels true for him. But I just want him to have like emotional literacy. I want us to be able to, I never want to push. I don't want him to ever feel scared to come to me in moments of conflict or I don't know. I hope we can just like get mad and upset and come back together, and that I'm not like, it's not me versus him.
Yeah. You're like collaborators.
Yeah. I want to be collaborators. In the way that I think about it in the classroom, where I'm like, I am holding the container. I am responsible for that classroom space. And it is my job to like guide and support, but I am not like superior.
It's not like there's something that you're asking of Charlie that you wouldn't also ask of yourself.
Yeah.
Or like as if you're infallible. If you're a teacher or a parent, you're somehow like infallible and can never admit that you wish you'd made a different choice or something like that.
Yeah, I want him to you know, when you get to that moment and you realize your parents are just humans and you're like, what the fuck? I want to be breaking that constantly. I don't want him to wake up when he's 14 and be like, oh, mom is actually just a person and actually they're kind of dumb. I want him to just know that now. And I want us to like build off of the fact that we're like, he is a whole human right now, and I am a whole human, and we're doing this thing together.
But it's like you are also proving yourself to be a trustworthy person, a safe person, an arms wide open person for him. It's like breaking the idea that in order to be a safe or trustworthy person, I also have to be always right. Yeah, yeah. I love that story. I love it because it's like a messy one. It's like so different than the image of you at the piano with your quiet children, you know, like it's like so different than that. And there's something like really sustainable and gritty and I don't know, like grit, not gritty, but there's like a grit to that that feels grounded, which is also interesting as we're talking about like wanting our kids to feel that foundation and that sturdiness. And it's like, that's what you're offering. That is sturdy. That's a foundation.
Yeah.
I think so. From all my wisdom and authority from hundreds of miles away. I definitely think so.
When do you feel like a quote unquote real mom? Like in your body, not in the, because it's so funny because that story is not, does not live up to any of my like mental images. You know, this like ideal of like, when I feel like I'm failing at being a real mom, it's not because I wasn't doing that moment. It's all these other things. But like in my core, in my body, when we're just laying in bed together and he's saying, you should apologize. That was basically like, that was fucked. You fucked up. And me to be like, yeah, dude, I did. I fucked up.
And that like gets to the heart of the thing that you're building with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like so many ways to think about this. Cause I, in a lot of ways, I do still feel very wobbly in this role and I doubt myself all the time. And that idea that you mentioned earlier, of like my children's behavior is a is like a reflection on my skills as a parent, is also very, very, very deeply in me. And so I mean, like starting very early, like when Otto, I remember like, I think like the second day Otto was here, he cried a lot as a baby, screaming, crying a lot as a little baby. And we were still in the hospital. And I remember I was like trying to soothe him and nothing was working. And I remember feeling like, because I couldn't soothe him, because I was trying to soothe him and he was still crying, that I had already failed. Like I'd failed as a parent. I couldn't do this, like not a real parent moment. And I remember handing him over to Micah and Micah pacing the hospital room, singing to him. I mean, I think for hours, in my memory, it was hours. And then finally, Otto quieted and stilled. And I remember thinking like, oh, like Micah went into the eye of the storm with him. And like, I shrunk from the eye of the storm. And like something about the way that he did that, I was like kind of in awe of it. And I think like for months or years, what is time? Like for a long time, I was kind of at war with that idea. And like Micah kept going into the eye of the storm with Otto in a way that I shrank from. And it was complicated because part of it too, like one layer of this whole thing, because nothing is ever one thing at once. Like I think part of what Micah was able to offer was like this bouncing and pacing around the house that I couldn't. And so there was this other layer of like, oh, I physically can't go into the eye of the storm with you. And that is like crushing to me. So there was the pain of that too. So it's like for this period of time, I couldn't soothe Otto. There were lots of reasons for it, and Micah could. And also this piece of like, because he's still crying, it's evidence and proof that I'm not this real mom. And I think the thing that has evolved for us is my strengthening my ability to stay with him and stay connected and present regardless of whatever comes next. And so part of that is like recognizing my strength for staying calm and staying near when he is like losing his shit, which happens pretty regularly for us. So I think some of the times that I have started to feel the most like a quote unquote real mom, or feeling my like, oh, I can do this and I'm actually good at this, is staying calm and connected when he is a tornado or a hurricane or whatever the analogy is. And I think part of that is recognizing that the fact that he is a hurricane right now is not because I'm failing at this. It's because he's a human being who has all of these emotions rushing through his body and he does not know what to do with that. It is new to be here and trying to do this. And for me to be able to breathe and allow him to be a human and let him know that he can trust me to be the same person, no matter how big his feelings are. Like that, that to me is like part of the point of what I'm here to do. And I can do that. I am actually really good at that. And I hope that that gets like inscribed into his body as he's learning how to be in his body, of like taking deep breaths and not attaching the screaming and the words that are coming out of his mouth, not putting a value on that other than just like, wow, your little body is feeling so many big things right now. I think that's one of them for me, where I feel like this is something I can do and I believe in the value of it and I can do that. I think another piece of it for me that has evolved, you know, like thinking about the physicality. I mean, I've mentioned physicality a lot, right? Like physicality of these other moms, physicality of Micah's body, pacing and bouncing around the house. I think when I have slowly eased into my particular physicality, what is that? And what does that have to offer Otto? And a lot of that is moving slowly and like collaborating through whatever the action or the motion is and figuring that out together. My body kind of demands that. And it also feels like an offering to him that might be different. So I remember when we first started going to like a little daycare a few times a week. And I remember distinctly noticing how quickly all the other parents like got into the school, scooped their kid up, got back to the car, strapped in the car seat. They're out of the parking lot. And we were always the last people in the parking lot. And at first there was this feeling of like not matching and the failure of not matching. And like, everyone must be looking at me like, I don't know what I'm doing because we can't get in the car. We can't do it. The very simple thing. But I like eventually I learned to like really relish the rhythm that we could take. And like Otto and I would just like stop to look at a trail of ants in a sidewalk crack. And we would get in the car and he would like, he had this pattern where he would like hop into the front seat and then I'd have to like somehow find a way to coax him back into his car seat. And we, it would be like talking to him about like the bear, like the little plastic bear in his hand or whatever it was, like letting that rhythm be what it was going to be and like relishing it and finding joy in it and connection in it. Like, this is a different rhythm that you have with me than you might have with your dad or your grandparents or your aunts, but like we move slow and there's like a lot to relish in that. And we have to collaborate a little bit more about like, and less as he's becoming more and more mobile, but like for a while, there was just more like bodily coordination that we did together that is actually kind of lovely and like learning to just like accept the differences and what the physicality of parenting will be like for me and like treasuring that. And also, I have to say, also grieving the things that we weren't. Like I don't think I've ever grieved my body more deeply than in those early days of not being able to bounce around the house with him in the way that he seemed to need. And as someone who has had a disabled body most of my life, it was new for me to have to grapple with like genuine grief and my body's limitations. So it's both of those things. Like the grief is there, but also I think I have felt more like a real mom the more that I value the kind of mom my body demands that I be.
I'm interested in when you talk about the bodily collaboration for making things happen. I wonder how much that is instilling an idea of consent for him. I have been really noticing how much I barrel forward, and I can. Until recently, which Charlie's getting so big, I can pretty much put Charlie's body in any place and anything I want. And my little sister is now living across the street from me, and her kid is a year and a half younger than Charlie. And she is so, I think we all just have these like certain things that we really hold to. And the thing that she is so good at is consent. And sometimes I'm just like, oh my God, put the damn baby in the car seat.
Don't have time.
You know, and she really, unless there is like actual danger, she really collaborates with him on what they're doing and how his body is moving through the world. And I am so impatient. And I feel like I have been really working on making things collaborative, letting Charlie bounce around the car when he wants to for a minute instead of just getting into this damn car seat. So yeah, I think in this, like, both and, like, wow, the things that he is learning and you are learning about, like, agreements and making things work together and not you just like barreling forward and him having to do what you're doing feels really special.
Well, and I have to say that I think it's important for me to note that I think if I could do that with more ease, I probably would. And so I do feel grateful for the body that I have, that I'm kind of forced to stick to my ideals. I'm really impressed by your sister of the restraint of that, because sometimes, and it's funny because like sometimes it's not really actually an emergency, but it like feels like it. Like, we can't just sit around here. We got to get in the car seat. We can't just sit in this pickup line. So I think that there is a way that like having something that forces me to actually assess, is this an emergency or actually can we kind of go slow? Does it matter that we get out of the parking lot as fast as the other cars are? Actually, like, oh, we don't have to. That feels good to me. I feel grateful for that.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
Woohoo! This podcast is edited and perfected by Amelia of Softer Sounds.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.